tons of people in the studio, I think. Dennis?
Yeah, I'm here. Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah? And you're training someone new?
Yeah, we got Keith happening right now.
Keith happening? Is that what we call him, Keith happening?
Yeah, that's the name, Keith Happening.
What is your last name, Keith?
Foster.
Nice to meet you, Keith.
Alrighty then. So we got Keith Foster, Big Dennis. So you got Big D and Keith Happening. And with us in a minute or so, we're going to be talking to George Kennedy. George Kennedy is our buddy. He's been on the program before. New England Motor Press member, part of the exclusive executive committee of the New England Motor Press. And this week in the New England Motor Press forum, we had the what we call the Ragtop Ramble, which isn't a lot of ragtops anymore, but it still is a ramble, which means it's an old-timey expression, which means a bunch of people in cars kind of ramble around and head to a certain destination. That's what we did. We went from the Lars Anderson Auto Museum up to Kennebunkport, Maine. We'll talk about that in a little bit. We did it in some pretty good cars, too, and we'll talk about some of those cars. So a lot of different things going on and a lot of things that talk about. Of course, we want to hear from you at 617-770-3030. But with us on the phone is George Five Lobster Kennedy. George, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning to you and your listeners.
So I started off with George Five Lobster Kennedy. Did you stop at five?
No. Let's get the story straight here. I had a more civilized four, okay? It was our other friend Josh Merva that had five.
Oh, okay.
It was only because they ran out of lobster. I want to get the story straight. It was not for lack of further desire to consume lobster.
Yeah. Well, let's do a little bit of background for our listeners here. This is a work day for everyone. This is where we started off on Wednesday night in the Seaport area. We were at the Boston Harbor Hotel, not the Boston Harbor, the Seaport Hotel, where we got together, mingled a little bit, and still the controversy is from the TV show Will and Grace, was the guy sitting at the bar Jack from Will and Grace?
Oh, geez, I don't know.
Rich from Wheels TV is absolutely convinced it was the guy who played Jack on Will and Grace was sitting at the bar. He did look like him, I will admit. But then we went over across the street to the harbor where we got on the Lexington, a paddle wheel style boat, and we drifted around Boston Harbor on a beautiful night. Had some good food on the boat. A pretty exhausting time, the best I could figure out.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, the paddle wheel style boat is, of course, native to the Boston area.
Yeah, exactly. And then we
clean up here.
Yeah, and then we the next morning assembled bright and early at the Lars Anderson Auto Museum, where we had breakfast courtesy of the catering truck, which was, I don't know, one of the best breakfast sandwiches I ever had.
Yeah, that was pretty darn good. You know, why? Because it was on Portuguese sweetbread.
Yeah, it was again a grueling work day, and then we then we got in the cars and drove a grueling 2.5 hours to Kennebunkport, Maine, where we were at the Ocean, what's the name of the place? Ocean House? Ocean.
The Old Colony.
Old Colony, yeah. And then Colony House, yeah. And then we were there where we ate them out of lobster.
Yeah, we cleaned them out of their lobster. And before your listeners, you know, turn off the radio in a rage of jealous anger, this day does serve a purpose. It's, you know, we get in front of a lot of the automakers and we talk to them, we tell them what we need for the year. You know, we try and get more cars. So those are the tools of the trade that help us write car reviews, you know, for our listeners and our readers throughout the year.
So it's not just about lobster?
Exactly. It's okay. Not just about the four lobsters.
Yeah, exactly. But we do make a stop in between where we swap off cars and have a snack in case we need, in case the breakfast sandwich on a Portuguese muffin wasn't sufficient enough, we had snacks on the way to sustain ourselves. Was there any car that you saw there, maybe you didn't even drive, but you were really surprised by either the performance of it or the style of it or something that kind of, this originally was called the Ragtop Ramble because everybody had a convertible, and that's not the case anymore. Convertibles are starting to get to be a little bit on the scarce side, but was there anything there that really surprised you?
I will say that the color of the BMW M4 there was pretty surprising. It was like purple Gatorade purple. And when I talked to the rep from BMW, he was like, "Oh yeah, that's a personalized option. That's their factory car, but they optioned it in a way that somebody would walk in, say this is the color that's not on their given palette." And it's a $6,000 charge on top of the whatever you're paying for an M4 convertible, which I replied. I'm like, okay, so basically that's so Mr. BMW, when he pulls up to the country club, somebody goes, "Oh, that's a cool color." So he has the opportunity to go, "Oh, thanks, it was a $6,000 option."
Yeah, and I got to tell you, if I looked at it and said, it's an interesting color, and I would want them to discount it $6,000. It was just not my color. I mean, it was not something that I thought, just looked at it and went, I'm not so sure. Go ahead.
I would say Matt from Car Gurus drove that up to the hotel, and it's funny, so he's a big Fish fan, and so he pulls up, the top's down, this Fish blasting, and I kind of had like Deadhead sticker on a Cadillac moment rushing to my head.
I can see why. The car that I drove back was the Alfa Romeo Stelvio Quadrifoglio, I guess is. That was a surprising car, but I'm not sure I like it. Stiff.
That's an X5 M competitor.
Yeah, and stiff okay. ride, really highly bolstered seats that apparently I'm too fat to sit in. Wasn't super comfortable to be in, but when you stepped on the accelerator and it got past about halfway and the baffles open up in the exhaust, it does sound really cool, and it is ridiculously fast for an SUV.
Well, yeah, that's the Quattrofoglio, Quattrofoglio, whatever.
Something Italian.
Clover, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those versions of those cars are exceptionally dialed in. The non-Quattrofoglio is a little bit more balanced while still providing like really good cornering abilities.
Right. Yeah. It was. And the other car that seemed to get a lot of press from people. You know, we don't see that many stick shift cars anymore. But I believe there was a little Hyundai stick shift car that everybody thought was pretty good.
There's the Hyundai Veloster N, yeah, which is cool. N as in Nancy is Hyundai's new performance line out to BMW M and Mercedes AMG, and they're trying to really push that. So that's a cool little hot hatch that they're going to put out there to compete with the likes of the GTI. The other manual car is one that I drove, which I'm actually smitten with, and that is the Fiat 124 Spider, the Abarth version.
Yeah, I have never driven that car, and, a lot of people kind of snicker at it and say, well, it's just a Miata, but it's not.
Well, and the funny thing is, too, like, I hate to say it, but, like, I love the way the Miata drives, but I would never see myself owning one, and part of that is sort of, this is the first generation of the Miata that's actually had, like, angry styling that's still a little weird to look at. I think they're great track cars, but, like, I just can't get around the styling. It's just not there for me. The Fiat does it. The Fiat kind of has this, like, modern take on a classic look, which is what other FCA cars do as well, like the Hellcat or the Challenger. So taking an older look and modernizing it, then that's just enough to get me there. And that car handles incredibly well. The shifter throws are super short. It's stiff but not too stiff. I mean, I'm 6'3". In that car is just a go-kart around me, and it's stupid fun.
And you fit in it okay?
As long as the top is down, sure.
Yeah. Well, you know, my producer Dennis is about your height, so you know, maybe that can be his next car. So, you know,
yeah, provided he only drives in the summer, and yeah, you kind of have to have a bit of a tilt or a scrunch when the top is up.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. Yeah,
but I absolutely love that car.
Yeah, no, it looks like a great car. I hope it hangs around a little while so I get to drive it, because I missed it. Last year when it came out, and I really want to see what it's like, because it looks like a fun car, and I had the folks on from Fiat probably, I don't know, a year and a half ago talking about the car, and it looks like a great car, and it looks like a lot of fun. You know, let's back up to where we started, the Lars Anderson Auto Museum. New exhibit there, what'd you think?
Oh, very cool stuff. So I'm lucky enough that I get to live about 5 minutes from the place. So Sheldon, the executive director of the museum, Sheldon Steele, gave me a little sneak peek before the exhibit opened up. And, you know, I did a story for it for the Boston Globe and Boston.com. And it's just really cool. It's hot rods, but not hot rods as you think of them. They're all hot rods that are done in New England, or from like the 50s, 60s, 70s, and even before that in New England, where the aesthetic, what you're going for, what your purpose of the modifications are different from somebody doing, like, you know, hot rodding in Southern California. So I give me hot rods without the Beach Boys, and that seems like my kind of realm.
and unlike California, the front of the cars sit lower than the back.
Yeah, right, because they actually want to take a corner.
Yeah, I never quite got the whole California look where the front sits high and the back sits low, and, you know, maybe it has something to do with traction dynamics, but for styling, it just doesn't do it for me somehow.
Yeah, and I don't like the chrome and stuff. Like, that corner of automotive enthusiasm just never did it for me. So I like that everything for the New England cars is, the theme is just been function first, and I love that notion of everything is following the function.
Hmm. Yeah, no, it's, you know, and a lot of people don't really think about New England as being a kind of a hotbed of hot rodding in that era, but, you know, right up until, well, I guess, you know, continues, but, you know, there was some pretty great designs that came out of New England.
Sure, I mean, like you said, it was a hotbed of performance, because if you look at Orange Mass, there was an airfield that was turned into a drag strip every summer. There were tracks darting all over, you know, New England. And then you go to the different dealerships, and you got Tasca had its the Ford Cobra Jet, which became the official Ford Cobra Jet down the line.
Yeah, it was, you know, Bob Tasca Sr., the guy who's not around anymore. You know, I had the opportunity to talk with him a couple of times, because he's sort of almost family with AAA, and he was, you know, so we sat down and talked a couple times, and he also, you know, the first SHO Taurus actually came out of his shop, not with the Yamaha engine, but it was he took and did a performance upgrade to a 3.8 V6, changed all the suspension around, made it handle well, put some low-flow exhaust on it, and took it to Ford and said, you need to build one of these. And they did.
Oh, that's, I see. I did not know that. There you go, you learned something.
Yeah, see.
I believe the story with the Yamaha engines was that Ford originally had caught wind that GM was building this, like, high-powered mid-engine car that was super small to compete with, like, the MR2. And that car eventually became the Fiero, but not before GM kind of neutered it by saying, look, if you make this thing with a V6 in its first years, it's going to be faster than a Corvette 0-60. At which point, of course, in GM's weird old archaic hierarchy back in the day, they would say, well, the car can't go faster than a Corvette. So they didn't let them have the V6 until the last 2 years. At that point, the car had been completely neutered, and it got a reputation as, like, a hairdresser car. And then Ford, you know, on the other side, being like, oh, well, the car isn't as big of a threat as we originally thought. So they were going to have these mid-engine, you know, these Yamaha engines put in a mid-engine car or a front-engine car, and that car was going to be a hotted-up version of the Ford Probe. once they realized that they didn't have to compete with a car like that, they made the Probe front engine, front-wheel drive, too. They had a bunch of these engines lying around, and those engines eventually made their way into the show.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah. And, you know, and you kind of...
I don't know how true that story is, but...
You kind of look at all that, and if that is really true, the Probe would have been a really good car, and the Fiero would have been a really good car. Instead, they were both, you know, so-so at best. The last year of the Fiero was the best year of the Fiero, and the Probe, you know, they changed the style around, smoothed it out a little bit. It really became just a rebodied Mazda 6, which is a great car, but on the other hand, it was never you know, kind of the hot coupe that it could have been.
Well, I get a reputation for, like, you know, crapping on GM a lot, but it's because they do things like, if they know that they don't have to put in X amount of effort into something, they won't. And so that's why you end up with, their Corvettes are great, their trucks are great, their sedans are kind of mezza, and, you know, if they can build a daily driver car for less, they will.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's years and years ago, I was... You'll find this hard to believe, but I don't get invited to a lot of parties. But I was actually invited to a party, and it was a bunch of people that I think I knew three of them, and it was kind of totally unrelated to anything I did. And I saw this one guy, and we got chit chatting a little bit, and I said, "What do you do?" And he said, "I'm in the fastener business." And I said, "What do you mean? Nuts and bolts and screws and stuff?" And he goes, "Yeah, I am." And I said, "Who? You know, do you sell the, you know, is it hardware stores?" He said, "No, primarily my customers are the big three automakers." And I said, "Oh, yeah. Who?" I said, "Who build, you know, what's the process?" And he said, "Oh, you know, they'll give us a door panel or a dash or something, and they'll ask us how many fasteners need to go on this to hold it in place for the life of the car." And I said, "Who does the best job?" And at the time, he said, "Absolutely, Ford does the best job." And I said, what about Chrysler? And he said, "Yeah, you know, they do okay. They look at our engineering. They, you know, make some changes on it a little bit." And I said, "What about GM?" And he said, "Well, there's a problem." He said, "We engineer, say, a door panel to have, you know, 15 fasteners on the door panel, four on the door handle, something on, you know, on and on." And he said, "They look at it and go, we need to be able to do it with half of this." He said, which explains why when it's new, it looks good, but 3 years later, the door panel's falling off the door because they just opted not to put enough fasteners on the car when the car was being engineered. And I guess I always thought engineering at the manufacturers designed how many pieces hold things together, but in fact, in this case, it was a third-party company that said, "This is what you need to do." Then engineering and probably accounting goes, "Yeah, you know, if we can save, you know, 12 cents per vehicle, let's save the 12 cents per vehicle, and we'll deal with, you know, shakes and rattles, you know, 3 or 4 years down the road when it's out of warranty."
Well, if your listeners want to read a great book about these sort of concepts, specifically around GM, just to prove that we're not just, like, have an anti-GM bias, but this is something systemic over there, check out Car Guys vs. Bean Counters. It was written by Bob Lutz right after the whole carpocalypse of, like, 08-09, and it talks about the sort of the institutional sort of blasé, the modern, you know, it was program managers, quote-unquote, not designers that would design the car. They would say, "Well, a Buick can't have a five-spoke wheel because that's GM's brand identity. Well, then how's it going to develop a cool-looking Regal GS or something like that?" So sort of the reverse mentality of their inner decision-making. But then you go to farther things. Like, I remember my my middle school science teacher, Mr. Massidi, always had Cadillacs, all right? And he kept complaining about this one Cadillac that he bought. I think it was a DTS or something. There was a rattle for the first 6 months, and he kept bringing it back, and they couldn't find anything. They finally took the whole car apart, and they found in the driver door panel a crumpled-up beer can that somebody clearly threw in there on the assembly line out in Michigan.
Well, I may have to call shenanigans on that, only because that story in one form or another has been around since, like, the 1950s.
Sure. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Only I think in the 50s it was a Coke bottle. But, yeah.
Exactly. Well, the one thing that's come back to the Bob Lutz book is that you know, if you're in, if you're intrigued about how these things work and how a car company can, that's successful, can sort of write itself into a, like, you know, mediocrity, that's a great book. But you got to remember, the author being Bob Lutz is a very strong personality, and sort of his conclusions is that everyone's an idiot except for me, and I'm the only savior for the car industry. I'm the reason everything is awesome. I'm Bob Lutz.
Yeah, well, that is true. I've met him a couple of times, I guess, and one of the times I met him, I said to him, you know, what got you interested? What do you remember? And he said, I remember being a small child, and I was my nanny was holding me in her arms as we were looking down over our front. I don't know, front of our home in Switzerland or something, as my father brought home his new Rolls Royce. And I was like, okay, I don't quite remember, you know, my first experience with a car being held in my nanny's arms overlooking the front 40 acres of my house as dad brought home his Rolls Royce. But
yeah, shared life experiences, right?
Yeah, exactly. Before we let you go, you're a Jeep guy. You love Jeeps. What do you think of this new four-cylinder Wrangler with the electric vehicle assist?
So I think it's a great call. The whole thing about the new Wrangler has been an awesome surprise because of how much hasn't changed, right? So, you know, they kept the V6 in a lot of ways. They kept a lot of the very tough running gear. But then they also realized that their bread and butter nowadays is the four-door Sahara crowd, right? And those folks aren't going to go off-roading. They might take it on the beach. Well, four-cylinder with the e-assist hybrid or e-torque mild hybrid system is a great compromise that is going to get the fuel economy ratings up that will allow them to still build vehicles like the Rubicon and like those other tough sort of off-road vehicles.
So it was a good decision. You're happy with it. You don't feel that a battery pack and an electric motor makes it less Jeepish?
Well, so here's the funny thing, that like those sort of weekend warrior Jeeps, that, you know, people are going to get those no matter what, and the more that Jeep can, it's all right, I'll give you an example. It's like Porsche, right? So Porsche clearly has a diehard purist contingent, right?
Yep.
But if it catered to just that diehard purist contingent, they'd be out of business by now. So they had to roll out with vehicles like the Cayenne, the Macan, the Panamera, cars that are not directly at its core but have elements of its core, and that keeps the brand afloat. So the Wrangler, you know, as long as you still build vehicles like the Rubicon that have the V6 and have all the tough running gear, you know, if you can offer, you know, plenty of buyers the Sahara with the four-cylinder hybrid, make them happy to keep coming back, well, all of those sales help the development of the next Wrangler. So I'm all for it. So I think it's a matter of seeing the big picture and realizing that just as much as Jeep is all about the off-road guys like me, there are those that aren't going to take it off-road, but they're still part of that Jeep community, and making sure you cater to them to keep that franchise going for as long as possible.
No, it really makes sense. And you brought up Porsche because I remember, I don't remember exactly when it was, but when, you know, Porsche came out with the 924 and the 928 and, you know, then the 928 S4, which were great cars, they were selling 1,500 cars a year in the United States. They pretty much almost went bankrupt during that time, and they were still, you know, no one can argue, you know, that the 928 S4 was not a phenomenal performance vehicle, but people were like, no, the engine needs to be in the back. You know, it's not a Porsche. And, you know, it almost killed them. But in fact, as they started to diversify, and I remember that the president of Porsche was out visiting the New England Motor Press, and he hinted that there would be a SUV with all-wheel drive and still handle like a Porsche. And I said to him, you know, when I see that, I expect to see a plow on the front of it. And and he said, you'll never see a plow on the front of it, and you will see it. And I, at the time, I didn't know if I believed him. And in fact, you know, here we go. And you know, there's some cars that have really helped Porsche succeed and have broadened up their market away from, you know, the 911 and the Boxster and the, you know, Cayman set.
Well, even the Boxer came in, and that was a big leap for them. Because, look, the last time they made a small mid-engine car was the 914, and I know people love those, but I just can't, like, rectify, or I can't get behind the looks of that thing. So that's a car that came Cayman and Boxster, that those also helped the brand while potentially pissing off some of the purists, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know Camille Kalouski, of course.
Of course.
I was with him, and he was in a Porsche Cayenne GTS, and we were going to Porsche Day at the Lars Anderson Museum. We go to roll up. And remember, this doesn't represent the museum, but sort of the community that shows up to the auto shows. We went to roll up to pull the car up on the lawn, and somebody, the car wasn't even in park. The guy knocks on the window and opens Camille's door and goes, "You can't park that here. Only old school air cooled 911s here." And I want to be like, dude, you realize that this car is the reason why your car is still around, why people still care about your car. The cars that they sell, of the SUVs and the four doors, are what keeps the 911 relevant. It's how they have the R&D money to keep making the 911 better. So, you know, if you're a purist, you should go up to somebody in an SUV like that and thank them for helping keep their brand afloat.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Hey, if people want to read more about you, read your stuff, where can they find you?
Yeah, sure. So I'm on boston.com/cars, cargurus.com, U.S. News and World Report. You can follow me on Twitter at gkens101. That's also my Instagram handle. And, yeah, that's where my stuff is.
All right, hey, we took 30 minutes of your life away this morning. Thanks for getting up early and joining us on Saturday morning here on the Car Doctor program.
You know it. Always happy to call in and talk to you.
All right. Take care, George.
That was
George Kennedy. George Kennedy, auto writer, has a variety of outlets you can find him in. Videos on Car Gurus, check him out. He been around the business for quite a while now, knows his stuff, obviously, and always a good guy to talk to, very articulate. Just a good guy. Why don't we take a break, pay some bills? My name's John Paul. This is the Car Doctor program. You're listening on AM 950 WROL, the Spirit of Boston. We will be back.
Get around, I get around, yeah, get around, round, round, I get around.
And welcome back to the Car Doctor program on AM 950 WROL, the Spirit of Boston. My name is John Paul, the Car Doctor, here to help you with your car problem on this Saturday morning. You can always join us at 617-770-3030, 617-770-3030. Wanted to talk about the car that got me around, not this week, but the last couple weeks, and that is the Mazda CX-9. The Mazda CX-9 is the largest of Mazda's SUVs. The very stylish CX-9 comes in four trim levels: Sport, Touring, Grand Touring, and Signature Edition. Front-wheel drive is standard. All-wheel drive is available in all trim levels. All models are powered by the same 227-horsepower turbocharged four-cylinder engine mated to a six-speed automatic transmission. We'll get to the horsepower in just a minute. This three-row SUV, like many of Mazda vehicles, handles surprisingly well. Although the CX-9 will never be confused with a sports sedan, it can be quite pleasing to drive on a twisty road. You know, if you find a little twisty New England road and you go, "Oh, it's an SUV, how much fun can that be to drive?" It actually is pretty fun to drive. The ride is smooth and a bit firm, but never jarring. The cabin is quiet with an absence of road and wind noise. Power from the 227-horsepower engine is quite good. In these days of 300-horsepower engines appearing in many vehicles, don't be disappointed only having 227 horsepower on tap. There's more than enough horsepower developed by this four-cylinder engine for any possible driving condition. But if you want about 23 more horsepower, according to whatever I read, all the things I read online, you can get what amounts to a 10% horsepower increase by running premium fuel. It's rated at 227 on regular gas. On premium, it bumps up to 250 horsepower. Pretty inexpensive fix, I guess, if you decide you need more horsepower. Fuel economy during my road test averaged about 25 miles per gallon. Safety is addressed with blind spot monitoring, rear cross traffic alert, low speed emergency braking. All is standard equipment. The interior on our CX-9 in our top trim level was comfortable with quality materials used throughout. First and second row seats were firm and comfortable. Adults will do fine in the second row. The third row, it's for kids. It's the third row is really not meant for adults, although I did crawl back there just to see what it was like. And, I guess a couple-mile trip, to a restaurant or the beach or something is possible, but you don't want to put a bunch of adults in this. It would be a little tight. The cabin itself is a bit narrow, having more of a cozy feel of a small SUV rather than a vehicle as big as it is. With all the seats in place, there's only about 14.5 cubic feet of cargo space. That increases to about 38 cubic feet with the third row folded. All the controls are generally simple, easy to operate, but the infotainment system seems unnecessarily complex, taking too much attention away from driving. Bottom line, the Mazda CX-9 is a stylish, fairly fuel-efficient vehicle that handles well. The CX-9 isn't the most powerful or capable of carrying the most cargo of the three-row SUV segment, but if you're looking for a family-friendly SUV that doesn't break the bank and has some of the best style out there, the CX-9 is certainly worth a look. And if that's the kind of vehicle you're looking for, go take a look, see what it looks like. Because it is a Mazda, we are going to do trivia today. We've been kind of missing trivia for a couple weeks because of vacations. I think last week I just forgot. It just didn't happen. This week Dennis doesn't like it because it makes him work harder. And he's a union guy. He's only designed to work certain. No, that's not real.
No, not at all.
But stuff happens. But I figured since we were working on training a new person, might as well do everything right. We might as well try everything out. So trivia. So get your finger ready to dial the phone or whatever people do to phones these days. When Mazda first introduced the rotary engine, there was a commercial that talked about how piston engines ping. What did the rotary engine do? So piston engines pinged. What did the rotary engine do? If you know the answer, give us a call at 617-770-3030, 617-770-3030, and we will send you out a nice prize. In fact, we'll send you out a prize that will make you a little bit safer. I was looking, and I still had one of those universal cell phone mounts that can go in your CD slot in your car, off your air vents, suction cup to the window, suction cup to the dash. Seems to fit just about any style phone. It has a little cutout for the power cord to connect to it for most smartphones. And since most people have smartphones today, about 80% of the market has some form of a smartphone or not, you'll be all set and you'll be able to do it. If you don't have Bluetooth and you prefer not to do it that way, you have some other choices. Just a reminder, at the Hebert Candy Mansion next Saturday, the 28th, from 9 to 2, will be the Volks Fair. You'll be able to see all kinds of cool Volkswagens, dune buggies, transporter vans, a good selection of vehicles, plus there'll be a 50-50 raffle, plus raffle prizes. There's 14 air-cooled Volkswagen classes. Should you want to enter, there is trophies for the 5 best. You can find out more information. Their website is the-bug-club.com. Spectators are free. Swap space is $10. Show cars are $15. VW parts vendors only. So if you have a Volkswagen and you want to find some parts for it, this might be a good place to go and check it out. I was watching. I got stuck in a YouTube, endless YouTube loop the other day, and I was watching a, I think the show was out of Australia, and it was two guys, and it was about building a sleeper car, so a car that looks pretty stock but has crazy horsepower engines in it, and it was, they took a, I think it was a 1971 air-cooled Volkswagen Beetle, and they put a Subaru WRX engine in it. And I don't know how many thousands of hours and thousands of dollars they put into this thing. But, and they also had, they were measuring horsepower in kilowatts, which I hadn't bothered to do the conversion, but the stock 1971 Volkswagen engine produced about 30 kilowatts of power. So whatever that might turn out to be, 60 or 70 horsepower, whatever it might have been. And the WRX engine that they put in this car generated 10 times the horsepower. So my best guess on horsepower was probably a 500 horsepower WRX engine sitting in the back of this Volkswagen. They had the radiator buried somewhere halfway around it. They had to move the firewall forward a little bit. It didn't intrude to the back seat much. It had they took the stock wheels in the back and cut them in half and added a couple inches to them, put the hubcaps back on it so it looked purely stock. The only kind of giveaway, instead of the two tailpipes coming out of the back, it had one single tailpipe that was about 2 inches, maybe 2.5 inches around. The front of it looked pretty stock. The because it's a turbocharged car, it had an intercooler stuffed up where the spare tire would be. It was ridiculous how much work they put into this. They showed them taking the transmission out. They had to do work to the transmission. They put a special clutch in it. And come to find out, the clutch still couldn't handle the amount of horsepower this thing was. But this thing was ridiculously fast, but absolutely looked purely stock. And apparently was a pretty easy to drive car. I don't think you'll see one of those at the Volks Fair, but you'll see some pretty cool stuff. And you might want to go over there and take a look. 617-770-3030, 617-770-3030 is our number. Let's see if Howie knows what a rotary engine noise made. Howie, is that you?
Yes. Didn't they eliminate the pistons in that rotary engine?
Yeah, and what kind of sound did it make? That's the question. What was the sound?
Yeah, I thought it was how'd they get rid of the pinging. I thought by eliminating the carb and the built-up on pistons, because they
but good thought. So people have to keep guessing.
Yep,
thanks, Howie.
I've been listening.
Right.
Bye.
All right, thanks. Bye-bye. So what was the sound that the rotary engine made? Pistons in the commercial, pistons pinged, but the rotary engine didn't. What was the sound it made? Another car show coming up. This is at Oak Point. A classic car show is going to take place at Oak Point in Middleborough. And this is going to be August 12th. It's from 10 to 2. It's rain or shine. It's a free event for participants and free admission for the public. Antique cars, classic cars, muscle cars, race cars, motorcycles. Musical entertainment by DJ Kev MacDaddy. Why don't they just call him the music guy, Kev, I don't know. The band is per diem. There'll be many raffles, a bake sale, bring a canned food item for the St. Vincent de Paul food pantry, 50-style drive-in style food. I remember drive-in food. It was awful. Free goodie bags and dash plaques for the first 75 vehicles registered. 50s costume contest. Paul Manette from Cruising Classic Cars will be there cruising New England. So this is at Oak Point. If you've never been to Oak Point, it is a whole village within Middleborough. I was down there to give a talk one day. Amazed at the amount of people that have hot rods and classic cars stuck in their garages down there. But this is going to be August 12th at Oak Point in Middleborough. It's 200 Oak Point Drive. It's right off of a road off of 44. I guess is the best way to describe it. But go check that out as well. Let's talk to our buddy Paul in Braintree. Let's see what he knows about old commercials. Paul?
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah.
So what do you think?
It hums.
Well, let's see. We have about a 50-second commercial. I'm gonna make you and the audience listen to find out if you're right or not.
Okay.
Dennis, what do you think?
I bought a new Mazda and went for a ride. Just me and my sweetie sitting side by side. It ran so wide we talked by the hour. That rotary engine gives you a quiet power. It's an engine go. But the Mazda goes. We took my Mazda out for a whirl. It's the perfect way to impress a girl. There's nothing like it on the road today. The rotary engine is here to stay. It's an engine go. But the Mazda goes. I thought she loved me, but don't you see, she loved my Mazda more than me. One day she drove off and left me behind, and all I could hear was that rotary engine whine. It's an engine go. But the Mazda goes.
Well, it sounds like you're right, and I'm pretty sure they can't have commercials like that anymore.
Yeah, I have it on Google, and the one thing I noticed, she drives off and the tailgate is way open, and it sort of shuts on its own.
Yeah, no, it is, it's like I said, a commercial. I don't think, you know, she was, they looked like they were both driving down the road and frolicking in the front seat a little bit.
Yeah.
And
no seatbelts either.
No seatbelts, and, you know, the girls are impressed and whatever other things they said, which I don't think they could get away with, so.
No. It was vintage in more than one way, I guess, you know?
It really was.
Yeah, about the moral standards of the day, of Maurice of the day.
Yeah.
But the tune was good.
Yeah, it was interesting. Dennis, any critique on the music? Or?
That's Dennis. Typical of that time frame.
You think so?
Yeah, typical.
All right.
Yeah.
All right.
It was what, the early 70s, late 60s?
It must have been, it was probably like right around
73 on it.
That
was a Wankel engine, but what model Mazda was that?
It might have been Cosmo was the one that was the sedan. That might have just been a Cosmo wagon. I'm not sure, but yeah, you know, the rotary engine's here to stay. Well, maybe not. You know, was in the commercial, and you know, and the RX-7 was around for a lot of years, and the engine was pretty successful in the end, but it didn't have the longevity they hoped it would be. They were oil burners; they tended to run hot, but they managed. And there's still some thoughts every once in a while the rotary engine will be out, and you know, people that know automotive history better than me, the original Chevrolet Vega and the other cars built on similar platforms to that. We're all supposed to be rotary engine cars, which is why the hood sets down so low. And GM decided the rotary engine wasn't for them, and they rather put a aluminum four cylinder engine in the Vega, which didn't work out so good. So
yeah, they're gonna say it didn't work out very well,
yeah,
did it?
Yeah.
Overheating, I think. Didn't they have meltdowns?
The typical fix was the blocks would actually warp, and rather than put a new block in with the warped cylinder head, you would put two or three head gaskets on the car, crank it back together, and hope that it held up. And that's what some of the repair shops were doing, and they didn't. But I'll tell you what, we'll put you on hold. Dennis will get down your address,
thank you.
And we'll send you something. We'll send you something, maybe a cell phone hold.
Whatever, that's okay.
All right.
Thank you very much.
All right, thanks,
have
Paul.
A great day.
All right,
bye.
You as well. So we'll let Dennis take care of that. And where are we going next, Dennis?
We got Robert from Tingsboro coming on.
Okay, well, let's talk to Robert from Tingsboro. Robert?
Hello.
Hello. I'm guessing you probably had an answer and you might have missed out, but we want to say hello.
I told Dennis I'd say hi anyways. I was just wondering, have you driven the 2019 Ram or the Silverado yet?
I have not driven the Silverado. I have driven the Ram about 500 feet.
No, it's not enough.
And not enough, no. But there was a Ram at the event we had just the other day, and everybody that got out of it, as good as the old Ram was, and people liked the 2017 and 2018, they right. think the 2019 is phenomenal.
Yeah, as far as what I've seen, yeah, I agree. I did take a quick look at on a lot. They were just all covered with dust. And there
yeah.
Spark, but, I got a 2014. Yeah, I think it's great. But them new ones, yeah.
Yeah, the 2018 Ram won the New England Motor Press pickup truck challenge last year. Uh-huh. They were just awarded, actually, this year for it. And the person from Chrysler said to me, was the award based on the 2018 or the 2019? And I said it was based on the 2018. Besides, you need something for next year's competition. And and it looks really good. The fit and finish inside is just getting better and better. The one that we had on Thursday was the 5.7 Hemi in it. Everything about the truck looks good. It has that kind of classic Ram look to it, but the inside of it, inside, I mean, this was a pretty fancy one.
Yeah, loaded.
Yeah, and it was a phenomenal looking truck, but all I did was move it across the parking lot.
Yeah, I noticed they're going the route that Chevy did back in like 99, 2000. They got the classic, which they're going to maintain
right.
some of the current models as a 19 until they exhaust them all, I guess.
Yeah, until they burn up inventory. Yeah, you know, yeah. GM did that. Ford did that with the F-150.
Yeah.
You know, everybody, which is better than what, you know, somebody I know used to work at a Fiat dealership, and they said to me, when the current model years didn't sell, Fiat would just send them new vehicle identification number tags, and they would drill out the old ones, put on the new ones, and suddenly call them, you know, instead of a, you know, 1963, they'd call it a 1964, and it was really a 1963 with a 1964 vehicle identification number. So I guess calling it a classic makes more sense than altering the
more
so,
legal.
Exactly.
Ford did that with the Shelby in the 69 because they didn't sell them all, so they bend them into 1970. So they never made a 70. They just took the leftovers and
changed them up. I guess I have mixed feelings about that. I guess knowing that you have the end of a serial number of the last year of production makes some sense. But on the other hand, if you have a 1970 that has a goofy VIN number, all of a sudden, you know, in 1970, it might sound like a fraud, but, you know, 40 years later, it's sort of like, well, what makes this really unique is it's really a 69, but Shelby opted to call it a 1970, and that, I think, probably makes it more collectible somehow.
Yeah, the fact that both those years are highly sought after and outrageously priced, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I guess you're right. Yeah, I guess you're right.
I think they put a spoiler on the front, and they painted two flat black stripes in front of those NACA scoops in the hood. And then that was it. Now it's 70.
Yeah, well, I'm pretty sure there's not one in my future. So.
No, me either, I'm afraid. Yeah. Okay, John, have a great day.
All right, take care. Bye-bye. 617-770-3030, 617-770-3030. Well, let's take another call. Good morning. You're on the Car Doctor program. Hello? Hi there.
Frank, you're on the air.
Frank.
Yes, hello. Good morning.
Hello. Good morning. Good morning.
I was moving my truck.
All right.
But this is the ongoing saga, the 2009 Chevy Traverse with the converter I've called before about.
Yeah,
and what happened was lately now that I took it up to Louisville to have do the converter.
Yeah,
and my daughter's vehicle, and they said that the code wasn't the converter, was misfiring on the engine.
Okay,
and they checked the oil and said it was down 4 quarts.
Oh, geez.
So she had taken it to a major store there that was associated with Kmart or whatever there. But anyways, and they put on four tires, and they were supposed to do a grease and oil.
Yeah.
And they charged her for the grease and oil. I don't think they ever did it. So she was driving it for another 4,000 miles without the oil being changed, even though she thought it was changed.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, so now it's like she calls up that company and they say, oh, we got no record of changing the oil, right? So she calls back the next day and they go, oh, it was a computer glitch. Yeah, we did change the oil.
Hmm.
So now it's like the codes on the engine there, it's misfiring on the first cylinder, it's misfiring on the fifth cylinder. It says here that the AFC certified master checks seen issues with these vehicles before. You need to replace your timing chain and related components. I mean, it's a disaster as far as... I'm going to take it to this mechanic of mine Tuesday, and he's going to take a look at it. The Lou's put in 4 quarts of oil and didn't even charge my daughter, which was, you know, I'm saying, well,
yeah,
at least if they showed they charged, you know, you could show. But I saw the other one doesn't naturally, probably doesn't want any liability.
Yeah.
On not changing oil.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know what to do. I mean, I got to see how bad the engine is Tuesday when they take it, because it was fine before when I took it for them for the converter, the same garage
yeah.
checked it all out and replaced 3 of the plugs and said that the engine's fine. So now it's
yeah.
on. And it's not fine.
Well, it's, you know, there was actually, at one point in the life of this car, there was actually a, some kind of, like, not really a recall, but a special service bulletin about timing chain wear, and, I don't know, it came out 3 or 4 years ago, and it was the Traverse, and it was the Outlook, and I think it was a Caddy, and maybe the Enclave, and the timing chain would wear. How many miles on this?
Right now, it's got like 92, and they had bought it used, so they still got a car payment on this
yeah.
vehicle. Yeah, and they bought it probably 3 years ago or something like
okay.
that.
Here's I was while we were talking I did some did a little bit of looking up stuff here. Let's see. On June 29, 2012, you got a pencil handy?
Oh, yeah, I can get one.
All right, go get a pencil. You need to write some
yep.
stuff down. All right. All right.
I'll be 1 second.
All right. You know, you're in your truck. You're going back
okay,
and forth. All right, good. Okay.
You got the pencil.
All right. All right, good. On June 29, 2012, they
uh-huh.
GM put out a bulletin. It's 11340 and the letter B like Bob.
Okay.
And it says special coverage adjustment time and chain wear. And it says special coverage adjustment. The special coverage covers the condition described above. The condition on some 2007 model, blah, 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 2009, different vehicles, so kind of in that time frame of yours, it says under
yeah.
certain conditions and with the vehicle's original oil change intervals, so, you know, they said you don't have to change your oil as often,
right.
the timing chain could wear prematurely and cause illumination of the service engine soon light. This special coverage covers the condition described above for a period of 10 years or 120,000 miles, whichever occurs first from the date the vehicle was originally placed in service, regardless of who owns it. The dealers are to replace the timing chain. The repairs will be made at no charge to the customer. Now, let's see. It says it's 10 years. So for vehicles covered by service contracts, we don't care about that. Involved are certain 2007 Arcadia, Saturn Outlooks, Cadillac CTXs, Chevrolet Traverses from 2007 to 2009 with the 2.8 or 3.6 V6 engine. So,
yeah, that's what it is,
yeah,
V6.
It says if the timing chain is replaced, the front end alignment is not required. We don't care about that. The timing chain requires verify the timing chain requires replacement. So I guess I would bring it to your mechanic just to see if they can verify the timing chain is not so good. And then I would go to your local Chevy dealer and say, hey, my mechanic tells me the timing chain is worn on this. And I understand, based on technical bulletin 11340B, that this thing's covered for 10 years or 120,000 miles. What are we going to do right. about it? Yeah. See if you can get them to put a timing chain in.
Yeah, well, you know, this is kind of ironic in a way. My other daughter had a Chevy Equinox, I think it was.
Yeah.
And there was something about a bulletin out on that for the engine there that sometimes the cylinders fail, the sleeve or something.
Yeah.
The cylinder.
Okay.
She was driving down 128, the engine cut out, and took it back to the dealer where she bought it, and they said, yeah, the engine's junk there, the engine failed. And they were trying to charge it for an engine, right? So my son-in-law looked up in the computer, and there was a printout saying that it wasn't a recall, but they would fix any engine that the cylinder failed.
Yep.
Sure enough, so we went to the dealer. I went with him, and the dealer was claiming that the spark plug was broken, and that's what made the engine fail, right? So I asked him to see the spark plug, and there was nothing wrong with the spark plug except for the insulator. The porcelain insulator was cracked and was sliding up and down on the electrode or whatever.
Okay,
what I'm saying?
Yep.
Says, geez, if you guys are smart, you would have took a hammer and smashed the spark plug. I said, because there's nothing wrong with this plug. There's nothing that came off of it and went into the cylinder.
Yeah.
So I says, and then we told them about the notice, and then they said, oh, well, we'll get back to you. And the next day they said, oh, yeah, we'll replace the engine. And I'm saying, well, what were they going to do? Were they going to have the General Motors pay for an engine and plus my daughter pay for an engine? Or what was going on there at that dealership? I don't know. You know what
I'm saying? It's a possibility. It's a possibility. So, you know, they get paid, about 60% when the dealer pays them. I mean, when the manufacturer pays them. So they get paid less money when the manufacturer pays them versus what you pay. And, because the labor rates are less. So, everything that is, you know, sometimes when you have an engine replaced, there's additional charges. We had somebody who listens to the show had a Kia that the engine failed, and they got charged an extra $400 for kind of incidentals. And, They emailed me during the week, and they said, do you think this is fair that the dealer's charging? And I said, if it's things like belts and hoses, yeah, those kind of things are going to be covered. But, for instance, you know, things like oil, engine coolant, power steering fluid, things like that, those are things that they need to put into the car. So, like, for instance, in this case, GM says that, you know, as part of the warranty, they pay for oil, they pay for the oil filter, they pay for the engine coolant, they pay for power steering fluid, they pay for transmission fluid, they pay for the gasket sealant and the refrigerant because you need to disconnect the, you know, AC lines. So, you know, there's some things that are covered because it's part of the repair. Some things you just, you know, you take a radiator hose off and you go, you know, this thing's been on there for 90,000 miles. It's a good idea to replace it. So you would expect to pay for those things. So I would go back, you know, again, have your mechanic verify that it looks like the chain's loose and bouncing around a little bit, and they can get a feel for that. And then I would go back to the dealer and tell them, hey, I know about this technical service bulletin. And you might be able to even just go online and Google that bulletin number, and you might be able to print it out too.
Uh-huh. Now, it said also on the codes, right, it said some of the codes were, you know, repeated. One of them said multiple engine misfire detected. Then it said next code was cylinder 1 misfire detected. Next code was cylinder 5 misfire. Then it says engine position system performance bank 1. What does that mean?
It's telling you that there's an issue with the chain. So that's telling you that, you know, when you know, kind of think old-fashioned with timing marks. You know, the timing marks should line up in the same place all the time.
Yes.
And the computer's sensing that the timing isn't staying consistent. It's varying back and forth a little bit. And that's a pretty good indication of a bad chain.
Now, what about with two quarts, you know, it's a six-quart engine, right?
Yep.
So with two quarts, Do you think there could have been a lot of damage if she was driving it?
Yeah, you know, chances are it was down a couple quarts to start off with, and then if they didn't change the oil, it burned through a couple more. Could it have done some piston and ring damage and, you know, bearing damage? Yeah, maybe, who knows? I don't think I might not tell
the
dealer.
Would it be worth doing a compression test on it when he?
No, I don't. Yeah, I mean, if it's running that rough, maybe. But if it's generally running smooth enough, I don't think I'd worry about it. I just, you know,
seems to be hesitating.
Maybe at this point, hope for the best.
All right.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Take care. Good luck with it. 617-770-3030, 617-770-3030. Let's talk to our buddy Rick. Rick, good morning.
Hey there.
Hey there.
Well, I can remember the first time that I was a car incident.
Yeah.
It was the early 50s. I was 4 or 5 years old, and my dad was pulling into the garage where he was going to park the car. And I got out when I was still moving, so you could probably guess why I remember it.
Yeah, I bet. You got a good memory, because I don't remember much before. I don't know how long. I don't have a lot of childhood memories that I can still think back about. But maybe if I jumped out of a moving car, I'd remember.
Yeah, and then your dad had a discussion with you.
so that's the part. Yeah. That's the part that lingered with you for a while. The discussion part.
Yeah.
Yeah. There you go. There you go.
My wife and I were down in Florida. We just got back yesterday, Annette, but we rented a vehicle. And one of the things that I learned was that from that incident was that don't just feel shop around and find the lowest cost, because we got hit with tire and battery fees,
really? You
know, coolant fees, and all that stuff added on to the bill.
And wow.
So next time I'm going to, ask a few more questions on the phone before I decide which one I'm going with.
Yeah, I know. The last couple of times, 3 or 4 times I rented a car, and this may sound a little bit self-serving, but I used the AAA app on my phone. And I go into car rentals, and we have an agreement with Hertz. But what I found is Hertz isn't necessarily the best price out there, but it brings up others as well. And the last time, I think I rented with Dollar maybe or somebody. And, you know, the fee structure was all set up, and they said as part of the, the AAA agreement, run the tank out of gas. It's included with the price. We don't charge you an exorbitant rate to refill the gas tank. We charge a regular pump price. So, you know, my goal was to bring the thing in as close to empty as possible, because they charge you not for, 20 gallons of gas in a 20-gallon tank, but they charge you for most of that. So you bring it in close to empty. And, you know, so the bill was whatever it was, $220 plus $25 to fill it with, for the gas fee. And that was, the estimate right up front was the same as the bill when I showed up. And in each case that I rented a car, and again, not through Hertz, but through the AAA app, what I liked about it was I didn't have to put any money down. So, I walked in with a reservation, but what I was also doing in the meantime was, every week or so, I'd go back and check and see if anybody had a better deal. And if they did, I would cancel it and go with the next one over. And they were all major, it was either Dollar or Avis or Enterprise or whatever the case is. And in all cases, I had pretty good luck. The one that kind of caught me a little bit by surprise was one of the rental agencies, they just said, pick any car out of, line, this row, and it was, I was surprised that they didn't just assign the car to me. The last car rental I got, I rented it at one airport and delivered it to another one, and I think that was the key to it, because I rented the cheapest car they had. I just went in and said, give me whatever the cheapest car is you have. It's going to be like, $200 for a week. And they handed me the keys to a brand new Volvo wagon. But I suspect that they needed to get the brand new Volvo wagon up to the other airport. So they were using me to sort of transport it. And they, you know, as I was filling out the information, it's like, and it was the same thing. Do you want wheel and tire protection? Do you want this? Do you want satellite radio? Do you want navigation? And I said no to everything. And this car had everything in it. This was the nicest rental car I ever had. And it started off as a Nissan Versa. And ended up as a Toyota, ended up as a Volvo cross-country wagon. And it was just one of those things I got lucky with. And again, I've had pretty good luck using the AAA app. So, if you have a smartphone or just go on your computer and use the AAA travel app, you know, again, I've had good luck with it.
Can I say one more thing quick?
Sure.
We're down in Florida. We found out, I heard on the news that there's a new scam out there where they'll either email you or send you a letter that claiming they have information that you're having an affair, you have pornography on your computer net, and you need to send them money to keep quiet. And I told it to my wife, and the next day she actually came across on her computer that somebody was claiming that on her and that. So just be aware that scam out.
Well, you know, if I get an email on my computer that says, I'm having an affair, I'm going to have a little party because, you know, I'm the most boring person there is, so.
Yeah.
All right.
Me too.
All right. Thanks, Rick. All right.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Before we take our next break, let's talk to Boyd. I think he's in, I don't know, he's around the corner, South Yarmouth or something. Boyd?
Hey, John. Good morning.
Good morning. What's up?
Hi. Well, I got a quick question for you.
All right.
I have some interest in the Mazda RX-8.
Yeah.
How do the Wankel engines, the Mazda rotary engines stack up, compare to a conventional engine as far as durability, you know, mileage? Like this car, a guy I know owns has like 47,000 miles on it.
No, they horsepower-wise, the RX-8s were up in horsepower. They were close to 300-plus horsepower. Fuel economy was not great, but it's a performance car.
The design of the Wankel,
That's true. And the early Wankels had longevity problems because it is literally a triangle piston, if you will, inside a circle. So if you drew a circle and put a triangle inside of it, that's what the inside of the engine looks like. So a spark plug fires
from Popular Mechanics.
Yeah, and it's
way back when they first came out with the Wankel.
And when you were working on one, if you were trying to measure timing or engine speed or anything like that, you actually would set your tack dwell meter to the 2-stroke cycle because that's it wasn't a 4-stroke engine. So it basically had a power and compression stroke and that's all there really was to it. So longevity-wise, the early ones, the lip seal, they had a seal at the end of the triangle, if you will. And those would wear out, and the things would burn oil like a diesel engine would. But over time, they made the seals out of kryptonite or something, and they lasted a lot better. So, but still, you're looking at an RX-8. It's got to be, what, at least 5 years old. And it's only got 50,000 miles on it. So longevity-wise, it's got plenty of life left in it. But it's not going to be a car you're going to drive every day. It's going to be a car you're going to drive on, you know, nice sunny days and enjoy it. And, you know, and again, the performance-wise, the turbocharged ones, I think they were turbocharged, you know, had great power. I remember the last one I drove, it was sort of the last one that was made. And horsepower was incredible, smooth as silk. You know, fuel economy, you know, was in the teens, you know, when just about every other car, including, you know, something with a V8 in it, a Camaro with a V8 or a Mustang with a V8 out on the highway was getting, high 20 miles per gallon. The V6 engines in those cars, we're still making 300 horsepower. We're getting 30 miles per gallon.
Right, like the Mustang.
Yeah, yeah.
What was that? The 24 horse. Got about 24 miles per gallon on the highway.
Yeah,
yeah.
And
it was pretty good actually.
Yeah, the RX8 didn't do that, but it was a unique and fun car to drive.
What would you say is the best you can expect on the highway?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe I have no idea. I would guess somewhere around 20s.
Yeah,
20-ish. Yeah, but again,
when at the time, because there's such high revving engines, I was wondering, never really how long. I mean, before you have to rebuild the motor or replace it.
The newer they get, the longer they last, and it really depends on. How it was driven and how it was maintained,
Did you have a test drive with RX-8?
Oh yeah, yeah. No, they were phenomenal to drive. But like I said, I think the last year might have been 2011 or 2012. Mm-hmm. The EPA, I'll tell you what EPA says. EPA says up to 16 city, up to 23 in the highway. So 20-ish. That's what you're gonna get.
I like 24, 25.
Yeah, well, you're not gonna. Yeah. It's a sports car, so drive like a sport, pay like a sport.
Yep. Hey, that's a good one.
There you go. That wasn't me.
All right. Did you enjoy driving it though?
Oh yeah, it's a fun car to drive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But was a five or six speed manual?
It was a six speed, the one I drove. Yeah. And again, it was all about. Just being different, and then they went from being different to now starting to get unique, starting to get the little be more of a collector's item. So this car might be a good value if you can buy it right.
Yeah, well, what do you now without seeing the car? It looks like it's in very good shape. I'll check it out, but. I wonder what kind of a price range is fair for that.
You got any? What year is it? Do you know?
It's about 6 years old, 7 years old. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's probably it may be the last one. The last year it might be like a 2011 or something. So
yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's really gonna depend on what kind of condition it's in, if it's showing any signs of wear and tear, that's really going to tell you.
Did you like the old RX-7s?
I actually, because they are what they are, the newer you get, the better it's going to be. So, You have to.
Octane is rated.
It's a premium fuel car. So you have to figure that you're going to pay for the performance, the compression ratio. It's all different. It's all different. But if you looked on a website like IC Cars or Car Gurus or something like that, and I'll be a little bit prejudiced with IC Cars because they carry my column. But you're gonna pay somewhere dependent on condition. Somewhere between probably I would have to guess somewhere between $9,000 and $12,000 depending on the condition.
Right.
I'm looking real quick on IC Cars, kind of a mm-hmm. nationwide search, and you said this thing had about 60,000 miles on it?
Actually, a little less. It's like 57, yeah.
Okay, so there's one in Austin, Texas. So, you got to think Austin, Texas, salt-free car, no rust, 2010. Thing they want mm-hmm. they want $9,700 for it. There's a 2011 in Minnesota with 100,000 miles on it. They want $8,500 for it. There is a there's another one with another 2010 in Norfolk, mm-hmm. Virginia with 53,000 miles on it. They want $10,700. So, mm-hmm. I mean, you're kind of looking at that range. There's one in Springfield, Illinois, a 2011. It's got 63,000. It's a fantastic mm-hmm. deal at 8,900. And it's whoever has this for sale originally had it listed at 11,900. And they dropped it to $9,000, so they took $2,000 off the price. So, so they're all over the place, but figure they're going to be around somewhere between $8,500 and $11,000.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you. By the way, speaking of back seats, you know that kind of different arrangement they have in the RX-8.
Yeah.
All right. For adults. I know it's not like a long ride,
No, it's meant for one person to sit kind of sideways back there, or it's a good place to put a small piece of luggage. That's what it's meant.
There you go.
Okay. All right. Take care, boy. All right.
Bye.
Bye-bye. All right. Why don't we take a break? Phone number 617-770-3030, 617-770-3030. We'll be right back.
Makes it alright. You say, baby, I ain't got no gas. Oh yeah, the Corvette. Baby, your mind's too fast.
Mustang Sally. You better slow your Mustang down. Hold on. What I said now, Mustang Sally now, baby. Hold on. Guess you better slow your Mustang down.
Welcome back to the Car Doctor program. Couple little news tidbits before we go. Volkswagen is coming out with a small SUV called the T-Cross. But Volkswagen's decided it's too small for the United States. It's not coming to the U.S. or Canada, but Volkswagen hopes its T-Cross small SUV will appeal to young families in urban areas almost everywhere else in the world. The T-Cross is intended to offer maximum amounts of rear legroom and trunk space in a small package. The vehicle debuts this year and will arrive in European dealers in the spring of next year. We're going worldwide with this, starting in Europe, then South America, both Chinese joint ventures, and finally India. VW brand small car product line boss Andreas Kruger told Automotive News it'll definitely be a no-show in America. Why don't we want small SUVs? I would think we want small SUVs, but... And, Ford's betting all their money on small SUVs because they're going to do away with all their cars. By the way, if you own a Ford Fusion, it looks like it's been recalled. They're recalling about 500,000 Ford Fusions, I think 2010 to 2014. Best place to always look for recalls, the NHTSA website, National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. You can put your vehicle identification number in, and it will tell you whether you're whether your vehicle has a specific recall. We talked with the folks at Prime Motors a couple weeks ago about something called Prime Flip, which was a subscription service where you could flip cars month to month if you wanted to. And an analyst for Edmunds says, subscriptions are a rich person's toy. Vehicle subscription service are trending, of course, as automakers experiment with allowing customers to make all-in month-to-month payments and giving them the opportunity to frequently switch vehicles. But is this really the industry's next big thing? Analysts at Edmunds put a pencil to the proposition and concluded that most automakers' programs aren't even worthy of the hefty price tags, even with insurance, maintenance, and other fees factored into monthly payments. Edmunds says subscription costs far exceed what consumers pay for leases at this price point. That they're selling a subscription service virtually makes no sense to anyone. Edmunds senior analyst Ivan Drury, during a presentation of industry trends in Automotive News, said, for example, a BMW's $3,700 per month offers a top-of-the-line vehicle such as the X6M under the company's Access by BMW program comes to double what it would cost to lease the vehicle. That's why I think the prime one actually made sense, because it wasn't a ridiculous amount of money. You could change every month, and you had the option, or you changed more often than that, I think, and you had the option of going back and forth. So it wasn't a $3,000 payment. I think it was something like $800 or something. It actually made it sound somewhat worthwhile. I think Paul Sullivan's in the studio. Are you?
Hey, why would somebody want to have a different car every month? I mean, I could understand every couple of years, but every month?
Some people get, you know, it's, you know, adult ADD.
I think they're in the witness protection program.
It could be that too.
Yeah.
Hey, did you ever know Greg Buckley?
Give me context.
Did some Irish singing from Brockton area. Actually, he's played a lot down the Cape and somewhere throughout Boston.
Not well, but the name, now that you give me the context, sure, makes why.
Well, he passed away.
Oh, I knew you were going to go there.
And I was, and I didn't get to meet him until I started coming down the Cape.
Yeah.
And I was reading his obituary, and it says, on Tuesday, July 17th, heaven gained a true legend, Gregory Big Gus Buckley passed peacefully away at his home after a brief battle with stupid cancer.
Stupid, yeah. There
Gus
you go.
Gus was surrounded by his obnoxiously close family, lots of Jameson, yeah. Lonesome Dove playing in the background. Throughout Boston, Cape Cod, and the South Shore, he was known as a mediocre guitar player who was saved by unwavering charisma and showmanship.
Hey, that's a good writer. That's a good writer.
I know. Whoever wrote this was great.
Yep.
A devoted family man, Greg's love for his children was only surpassed by his storybook love affair with his wife, Nancy. His loves included fishing, whiskey, politics, golf, and Red Sox. And, you know, whenever anyone would buy him a shot of Jameson, he would always joke that if his wife, Nancy, called, it was his first one of the night. So, he was also an amateur boxer in his day. Wasn't an old guy. He had a year round tan, it seemed like, and he was a good guy. And I remember talking to I found out he was from Brockton, and come to find out his wife was really good friends with my cousin, so we had this little connection.
Yeah.
And he lived in Dennisport. He had a billion friends, and just a good guy. And the world lost a character, and that's the best way to describe him. He was a good guy, a good entertainer, and when he was playing locally in Dennisport, even to the point where he would have other people come in and play with him, always had a good crowd. So, my condolences to his family and.
Mine as well. And just the hearing you read what someone obviously very close to him said and how it was written, you can kind of read into that there is a lot of love involved.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Very best in Irish music coming up with Paul Sullivan and the Irish Hit Parade. Sully will take care of you for the next 3 hours, and on to Matt and on to Bill Bailey after that. Until next week, make sure you wear your seatbelt, drive safely, and be good to your car. Talk to you all next week. Bye-bye.